Now we're recording. This is the February 18th statutory interpretation class. And for those of you not here today, your compatriots have let you down by failing to tell me to record the review. Our topic now is textualism. And to sort of get the discussion set up, I've asked in general terms to the about a third of the class, surprisingly, who views themselves initially as potential textualists, what are the advantages? Why sign up for this philosophy?
First off, I guess when the statute's written, people have access to them. They can read them and they can interpret what that says on its face. They don't have to look further into the purpose of it. They don't have to go back into legislative history to figure out what Congress actually meant.
So why is that a good? As a lawyer, I actually prefer that they can't do something like that.
It's good for people to know.
Why? What's the philosophical underpinning for saying it's good for people to be able to read and understand the law?
It makes it more.
It's axiomatic. It doesn't require explanation.
It's more bright line, I guess.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's easier. It makes it more clear cut and not as wishy washy of, whoa, it means this, oh, it means this.
That's such a mean way to put it. Wishy washy. All right, clarity. Ease of administration.
Yes.
It's easy for the police to arrest you if they have black and white text saying exactly what you did wrong. Is that a fair? I don't want to put words in your mouth. So I'll simply say ease of application. I'm sorry, I started tormenting you, but I never really got to the final point. Why is it good that you want people to be able to pull the law off the shelf and read it and understand it?
It's consistent.
With what? I'm genuinely curious what you're thinking. Yes. I'm genuinely curious what you're thinking.
If everyone has access to what that means, and sure, everyone has access to Senate reports and all that kind of stuff, but like, this is just more in your face, this is the summary, that's what people look at, and those aren't, those are the rules, just follow the rules.
So fairness. Everybody can pull it off. Everyone can read it. Everyone knows what it means. Nobody is advantaged in any particular way because they can understand a law that others can't.
Or manipulated.
Wow, that took such a dark turn at the end. All right, I'll just stick with fairness for now. Okay. Is there anything else we can tease from your concept that it's good to have citizens understand the law?
Yes, representative democracy.
So, promotes democratic values and respect of law. And for those of you in the back row, I apologize about my handwriting. I can tell you it's going to get progressively worse as we go along. So, if you can't read it, flag me, okay? All right. Okay, so. Anything else we can add to this? Right now, I'm feeling like we should be watching a baseball game and eating apple pies. Is there anything else we can add to this list? A hand goes up. Yes?
It respects the balance of power that is the legislative branch's right and duty to create a law on the judicial branch.
That's a wonderful answer. It respects the constitutional structural formation of the government with the allocation of power between branches. And doesn't let judges exercise the legislative power expressly allocated to the congressional branch. Okay. I'm going to be unfair and just boil that down to separation of powers or constitutional.
Perfect.
Okay.
Integrity of the Constitution.
I'm just going to put Constitution. I think we all know what we're talking about there. All right, anything else?
It's hard to manipulate going by a clear reading or by going by a textualism approach.
But we just heard it was easier to manipulate.
No.
Harder to manipulate. Oh, okay. I misheard you then. I'm sorry about the dark turn comment. So how is it harder to manipulate?
Because lawyers we're kind of trying to be able to, or judges even, to like, oh, this is what the policy said. When you can read different parts of the history, and kind of, you can come to two completely different conclusions a lot of time when you're looking at the history or the intent or the purpose. You can manipulate like what's black and white on a page and kind of the strikingly opposing conclusions.
So if I was to do something really dangerous and channel Scalia here, you don't want to let judges use legislative history as a Rorschach test to impose whatever view they might have in the whole, because legislative history is so broad, you can pick and choose from it.
Exactly.
Is it necessarily always a good thing? You can't manipulate the law.
That would be a con too. I mean, you can't say it's a pro or a con because you can say that it's good not to manipulate it because you're sticking to what the text says, and it's not fair to be able to enforce your own beliefs on it. But you could, on the contrary, say that if a statute was passed 150 years ago, it's not, if you're going by just what the text says, it doesn't, and you do that, it doesn't align with the current purposes of what it should. So there can be a con, but I think that that con is minor in comparison of being able to manipulate everything that you want to manipulate. And I would also add on to that I think it's good to start with a textualism approach and go by what the statute says, but maybe if something is so clear that it's absurdly against that, maybe then you could start looking to other things, but that would be a very rare exception.
Okay.
To kind of soften it slightly.
If I could put a small post-it on that comment and circle back to it at the end of class.
Okay.
I like that thought. But let me circle back a little bit earlier. So you would agree with the Bob Jones decision, or you disagree with it? Bob Jones University was when they said racist institutions are not entitled to tax exemptions.
Yeah, I mean, I know that sounds harsh, but you should go by what the text says, and I think that it's safer overall to let that be amended than to let people. I mean, what meaning is there in the law if anyone can manipulate it? What purpose is there in the law if you can put whatever your beliefs are on it?
And as much as I would love to argue with you about, I'm going to pause at that point because that is a very clear and valid statement of the philosophical launch point for this particular approach. I will also, just for those of you third who held up your hand saying you're textualist, how many of you would be like Amanda and say you agree, I'm sorry, you disagree with the Bob Jones outcome and that you would upheld tax exemptions for an expressly racist university? And no, it's a fair point to make. Rehnquist made it. You're trusting Congress to act.
I think it's just the emphasis that you put on express.
Yeah.
No, Mark, no doubt. I'm genuinely interested because this is sort of the courage of your convictions time here. If you really believe yourself to be textualist, you might find yourself holding true to what a statute says, even if it is patently obnoxious, but you're going to trust Congress to fix it. So, anyone would, is it, am I fairly capturing the spirit of our textualist contention here? Sorry, you had your hand up as well.
I'll do it.
Sorry? Yes.
I think if you specifically, if I read the statute, I think you could get away with, allowing them to still maintain their exempt status. However, obviously their motive for striking down through that statute is pure and it is good. So I think you could try and find maybe another means of getting rid of their tax exempt status. Maybe.
I like where you're going, but I'm not sure what's the other means. If you are
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Good thing I wasn't the judge. So.
Oh, I could have so much fun with that. Yes.
Well, did it
I'm sorry. You've been so patient. You had your hand up a couple different times. I keep skipping around. So what do you need to say? I'll come to you next, I promise.
I was just going to say, if you argue the exact opposite of what Amanda was saying, just because if you're a strict textualist, then you're looking at exactly what's in the statute, which makes it kind of easy to find loopholes. Not like a statute can't cover every situation, whereas if you look at the spirit of the statute, then you can punish somebody for doing the act that you're intending to punish, and they don't get off on the technicality because they use a switchblade instead of a kitchen knife or whatever that
is. What a great analogy. Is that from one of your classes up here? That's from your personal one? Sorry, I should have asked. Fair enough. The mind is a wondrously fertile place. Plain text, if construed strictly, leaves huge gaps. But you can drive through all sorts of anticipated situations if you stick to the black letter law. So you're not a textualist. Okay. Now, I'm back. I'll simply say that note kind of threw a flag, but I'm not sure it does it justice to the history of the situation. The Department of Justice actually did a memorandum of the existing tax exemption, which said basically, yes, it's a public school. The Civil Rights Act expressly barred discrimination, but purely private schools lack the element of state action, which would allow the imposition of that requirement. And that was the background up to the Bob Jones case, when IRS changed course under DC District Court issues in judgment. So you're kind of making the assumption Title VI sort of like five, you know, that sort of applied, and I'm not sure that's fair. But you think about one. You know, of course, then the whole case goes away and you don't have anything to read. Okay, so if we capture everything, I mean there might be
I just had one counter argument to Bree's comment that it's basically just that if we let Congress have that power and take it away from the judiciary, they're gonna have to be more familiar with their statutes if they want them interpreted that way. So it just encourages clarity and enforcement on their part.
So if you want the weapon, you have to be trained on how to use it properly. Congress has an enhanced duty to write clearly, crisply, and accurately, which I must say, the textualists are showing a deep and almost touching faith in the congressional drafting process. Yes, keep going.
The only pattern I would say like, to that is just like the efficiency of the laws, like having to write so many laws over and over to like, get it right inside instead of what, like actually following the process. Because I would say you would have applied for like, the law to the situation now, like the social changes, which like the only thing that I could bother you about textualism is you're saying they have to say exactly what they mean now in the current time, which just cause like Congress to have to make like the law every time.
And in a way, you are making my job extraordinarily easy because I'm going to come back to you. That is the perfect segue to the rise of the regulatory state. Congress can't write it all. So they hand the ball off to agencies, and agencies fill in the gaps. And then lawyers get very busy trying to figure out how to make sure the two actually join up together. Gosh, the hands keep going up. This doesn't have to be the last comment, though.
Move on, it's okay.
No, that's all right. Let's hear it.
Across the country, language is probably more, compared to people's values, language is going to be more consistent, how people interpret language. So one judge may construe the purpose of a statute completely different than another, but say two people are asked, what is a car, that's going to import they're going to have much similar ideas imported. Then what is fair, or what is it,
And that's an excellent point. The last thing we want is a statute with the same words that have different meanings in different parts of the country because of regional variations in understandings of language.
Right. I mean, I think there's always going to be exceptions to that. And that's why I think the softer textualism is maybe a little better. But
although I might argue with you later as to whether or not that's an oxymoron. I said that was the last one, I can't resist. What?
Okay, so this is an argument for textualism. All right.
I'm okay with textualism.
Okay.
I'm just going to make sure you guys sort of have you come to your own shores with it.
But if we look at little parts of the statute for interpretation, for example, what is peering? As in criminal law, we've determined that to be looking into a room. We use outside sources to determine what little parts of the statute mean. And why wouldn't we look at outside sources for the entire meaning of the statute?
Well, that might lead to the last two points that I might add to your list, which, by the way, is a great list. What is the law? What is, by constitutional standards, the only legally binding output from Congress bicamerally reached and signed by the president? only the text. Scalia's deeply rooted conviction, I don't mean to pick on Scalia, other judges and justices believe this strongly as well. The Constitution does not give any binding power to conference reports or floor debates or intention of any particular congressman. That's basically window dressing. The only thing the Constitution gives power to is the text itself of the law. So, only. I told you it was going to get bad. Equals law. And the last, before I say this, how many of you hope someday to become a judge? Anyone? Maybe, kind of, if everything else goes well. And you...
Why not?
Okay.
Just follow the path.
If you were at some point deciding to be a judge and you were gearing yourself up, what would you want to study to be a good judge? Besides just being a good lawyer, of course.
Legal clerks
are possibly
people to research for me.
That's right. She's looking for law clerks right now, guys. I think the question is designed to make people go, well, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, everything that we're taught to look at, I guess.
Well,
anywhere that you can seek to find an answer in some way, in some guideline.
Well, most judges, or are people in this room, which by the way, thank you for those of you who respond to my request for background information. This is one of the most diverse and experienced classes I've ever taught. You guys have done some amazing things. But when you walk out of the homogenizing process of law school, you'll all be lawyers. Most judges have that background. We're not typically going to see chemists, computer software engineers. We're not going to see semiotic specialists in ancient languages. We're all going to see mainly people whose primary training is sitting in classrooms like this. So the premise here is, if you're going to be a judge, the odds are pretty good you're going to be spectacularly ill-equipped to do the things in evaluating larger public policy. You're going to be, perhaps sad to say, not as well equipped to understand the legislative process if you've not actually lived through it. Some judges have, but most haven't. So the last one I'll add at the bottom, in that special place in the board which makes it invisible to everyone in the back row, judicial competence. Judges are great at reading text. That's what we do. That's our group. But everything else that the interpretive enterprise might call for, if you're outside of textualist school, you're really asking judges to do something that they may not really have the tools to do. All right. So with that in mind, this is sort of, I want to have these as our axioms, our principles, because this is our topic for today. Any questions or anything else you guys want to add? If I captured your guys' spirit here, what textualism is all about, why you like it. All right, for those of you who didn't raise your hand as textualists, if I had your thing you hate about it, you think it's a really bad idea. Okay? I'm assuming silence is consent, which is like congressional acquiescence. All right, so with that in mind, let's turn to our first case. And here you have the misfortune of having an environmental case, which means I'm just going to be really hard-pressed not to get into this one with you guys. This is not only an environmental case. We're talking about the Tennessee Valley Authority versus Hill decision, 1978. This is one of the seminal environmental cases. And not only that, it's one of the seminal statutory interpretation cases. It's a twofer. So with that in mind, I'll pause, I'll take a breath, and I'll ask one of our reading panel to start, give us the background. What are we involved with here in this case? Thank you. I hate to do this to you, but how do I pronounce your first name?
First name or last name?
Well, either one.
Royce.
Royce! I'm sorry. I thought your first name was a name.
What?
Never mind. Royce! You are now Royce for the rest of the semester with me. Royce! Okay. Thank you. Now I totally derailed your train of thought.
Alright. Basically, there's a snail that was declared in the
A snail darter. I'm gonna really instantly date myself here. How many of you have heard or know what a snail darter is? Yes! Right. What is a snail burger?
I don't know if you've heard of it. I mean, I. it's a tiny little fish.
Yes. And actually, you have your fingers out in exactly the right distance. Make a very anonymous form of minnow. Tiny little brown, designed to blend into muddy water. And snail darter has some unusual aspects, namely, it can only live in clear, crisp, running streams. So imagine that you're a happy snail darter, a small population living in the backwaters of Tennessee. Your happy fate with something that's a dam downstream and blocks your river. But with that in mind, Royce.
All right.
I'm going to do this thing repeatedly. I'm up in this case, so let's keep going.
Well, the snail darter was declared an endangered species. Tennessee River was like the only place where they had a bunch of habitat. However, part of the river would be flooded by this dam that they're putting up. It's called the Teleco Dam.
Teleco Dam.
Teleco Dam. And Congress has invested a lot of money into this dam, $100 million. And it started in 1973, before this act, to basically preserve the life of endangered species. And it was almost completed, it was second completed in 1976. First of all, this is a Congress-funded dam, so this is where everything starts to get really interesting.
Well, now we're starting to diverge into the legal analysis there. So I want to make sure we can set the stage, because this case is just too delicious. So keep going.
Okay, environmentalists, you know, basically sought an injection to stop the dam so they can preserve the life of this snail darter.
Can I add a little bit there?
Sure.
You're right, environmentalists, but the case doesn't say who the environmentalists were. And I'm not asking you to look. This is an unfair question. This is more you might be interested to know. Lawsuits. This is a case brought by lawsuits who decided that they were going to fight the flooding of this valley and the extinction of the species. It essentially orchestrated by a law professor. They filed this lawsuit and made this case happen. So guys, we have the power. If you want to do this, come talk to me. Because you're after we can monkey wrench. So keep going. Sorry, I interrupted you. Now I've just worked your train of thought for a third time. So you were saying that I interrupted you.
I think I'm a bit of facts, right? Environmentalists like sought to, law students sought to, fund an injunction to stop the dam from being, built to the life of a snail darter.
How do they file for an injunction if there is no endangered species act?
Endangered species act. Well, that was a tricky part. I guess the plain text of the language of the act that was enacted basically said that you could, by all means, anything to stop.
And you're absolutely correct. When the ESA got passed, you're absolutely correct. That's only following the second lawsuit. But there's actually an initial one under what's called NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. It was the very first environmental law. That's not in the textbook as well. I just want to let you know. They basically took a law, they stopped the dam both its tracks, they held it up until Congress passed a new law. And then, as soon as they lost the NEPA lawsuit, they filed another lawsuit under the new law and stopped it again. So this is a great case for your environmentalists. So now I've tortured you sufficiently. How did the court decide? Did the snail darter live?
Basically, district court denied it because the project was initiated before the act to preserve the lives of these snail darters. And then the court appealed the first or the lower court
Bryce, I hate this to you, but I can hear you, but I'm pretty sure the recording can't pick you up. Can you speak a little bit more clearly?
It's a first. Court appeals reversed.
There you go. That's your court voice.
And basically ordered the court to enjoin completion of the dam, meaning that the injunction was basically granted and the snail darters were saved.
Yeah. You make it sound like the tail end of this episode of the cartoon series. But yes. So that was the D.C. Circuit determination. Then it got to the Supreme Court, which is always a bad thing if you're an environmentalist. I shouldn't say that. But Justice Berger wrote the opinion, which is also a lot of people were thought they were dead, basically, when that came about. What did Justice Berger conclude?
Basically, the language of the statute, it gives no exception. So regardless of how much money that has been invested in this project, we must do everything in our power to basically save these snail darters. And they basically compared, used a lot of analogies, basically comparing the snail to snail darter to something like to the unknown. Basically, the snail can lead to like some kind of cure that can help cancer or something special. Basically by Congress, basically going along with this dam, they're going to be ruining something that can be beneficial for society as a whole in the future. So they ruled in favor of shutting down the dam and preserving the life.
If we can pause for a moment, let's consider the full gravity of what Bryce has eloquently precisely described. This dam was built. They had poured the cement. The locks were ready. They had already moved towns out of this valley. All they had to do was basically very few minor fixes and throw the switch and they were going to flood the valley. They stopped a major public construction and basically said that money was wasted. And you said because the language of the statute, according to Justice Berg, was clear. Now, we've been talking about the environmental side of this. Now we're going to start going, remember I told you every case we read in this class, you need to read through two lenses. The substance of the decision, but then also the tools, the actual really detail of the analysis they use. So, Royce, I'll keep running with you, but you can also call on your fellow panelists here today if you'd like. Hey, when you say the statute said, what are you talking about? What language of the statute are we talking about?
All right. She throws herself on the grenade.
Yeah. It's section 7 of the statute, which it's very words deliberately command all federal agencies to ensure that actions authorized, funded, or carried out by them do not jeopardize the continued existence of an endangered species or result in destruction or modification of habitat of such species.
So, and you're reading this off of page 554?
Yeah, it goes
from everyone else has your textbooks.
So, that was a nice reading. Which words in there tie the hands of the court and say that they cannot allow the stand to open?
The words ensure, authorize, funded, and carried out.
Okay.
Jeopardize and result.
So is it those words in particular? Is it the lack of other words for any kind of exceptions or balancing or cost effectiveness assessment? Well, I'm simply saying, is it not only just with the words that are here, but also the words that aren't here?
Yeah, it's if it's no exception. There's nothing in there that says, unless these standards are met, then you can go ahead.
All right, and you have to call me on this. I'm committing the sin, which I try never to do with you guys, which is I have something in my mind, and I'm fishing in the way the sort of leads you to what I'm thinking. My question was, yes, there are not words in there, but earlier versions of the statute had those words.
Yes. Well, that comes to that's a later argument. I'm not worried about starting to play language.
We go with what's best. You don't have to go with chronology.
All right. Okay.
But anyway, plain language. Just so we can ride that horse, we'll come to the second one then. So plain language basically says ensure, it's categorical language, shall.
Yeah, it doesn't talk anything about unless the sacrifices or anticipated benefits from that action outweigh in any way. It just says you have to ensure no matter what that all these actions authorized by the are carried out on purpose.
Okay, yeah. All right. I should pause here. There's an entire class on the Endangered Species Act. It's taught by Professor Urban. He is one of the leading practitioners nationally on the statute. I'll talk with you a little bit at the end of our discussion of some of the cases he's doing, but point being, this is a rich, fascinating, fun area. So I am going to throttle back my desire to give you more history than you could possibly ever want about it. I'll simply say, if I could elaborate a little bit on the language you just read in Section 7. The Endangered Species Act imposes what's called a consultation requirement. Consultation requirement simply says anytime a federal agency wants to engage in an action that could affect an endangered or threatened species, they can't do it until they first consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service or another branch dealing with aquatic animals, and basically get their staff biologist to say, it's okay, this will not jeopardize the species. If the biologist disagrees, you're done. Under this language of Section 7 as it was written, that project dies if you don't get the sign-off of the consultation process. As you can see, this is an extraordinarily powerful tool. The decision is not being vested in elected officials, appointed personnel. It's not given to anyone who's a manager or a bureaucrat. It's given to people whose life's mission is protecting the biological integrity and species that populate our planet. So as you might expect, a lot of division, a lot of projects subject to consultation have to go through a lot of hoops to get the biologists to sign off on it because of the way this language has been interpreted in this case. Now, you've said the plain text. Why not stop? Decision, this could be a one-page opinion. Okay.
And their understanding of
the
language.
So, Shrock, are you one of the textualists who raised your hand as well?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Royce, were you one of the textualists by chance?
No.
Oh, man, I've got a non-textualist reading panel today. And my last hope is Coda. How about you?
No.
Man. All right. I was going to say, would it be fair if you're a textualist to say, it's okay to look at legislative history as long as it supports the answer you like?
I feel like textualists do have to.
Okay. Guys, you can get back at her later in our conversation. All right, so he goes to legislative history. And what's it about legislative history that corroborates it?
Well, first they look at congressional hearings that pretty much support the idea that the previous acts had encouraged, I think, core strategies of encouragement as opposed to just clear, like, you can't harm these animals. We were encouraged to be aware and try to do actions that didn't harm their ecosystems or their existence.
So if I could sort of, the terms used in the decision, the Department of Defense could take a look at the endangered species and take steps to protect it as long as it didn't detract from their primary mission of protecting defense and conservation. Which means basically you would stick a fork in it and the species is done.
Yeah, you'd be like, oh, okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
But this is a bigger cause to move on, and that.
But that's not a fictional example, by the way. The Navy used to do bombardment exercises next to the Wilkin Crane wreck. It's an interesting. Keep going, please.
Yeah. So they looked at congressional hearings and prior language that kind of allowed for primary purposes, or insofar as it's practical and consistent. Primary purpose.
Right. I'm going to ask an unfair question, which you guys can share as well. Is this starting to turn into gumbo in your head? In the sense that we talk about legislative history, and it's like, well, there's statements on the floor, there are reports from certain committees, there's some sort of indications of testimony.
Hearings,
okay. So would it might help. It doesn't do this in the opinion, but there is a sense of precedence as to what is more important. Notice that they do quote, but they quote predominantly from the conference reports, and the committee reports that actually conducted the hearings and the markup of the bill. That's sort of the primary.
But wasn't it on a different bill?
Yeah, but it ultimately became this core that language translated to the final bill. Yeah. But you raise a valid point, by the way. A lot of legislative history is on sibling legislation that actually never gets passed, but judges will often port it over to the final legislation.
Yeah, which seems like a very weak argument to me, because that's, like you said, not what really got passed. But again, there's a whole bunch of different things used to support the meaning of the It's like an extra legacy of that.
Fair enough. And I like the way you elegantly wave your hands as you're saying that to sort of convey the sense of what you're saying. All right, I'm an opera fan, you probably should not confess that. All right, so let's keep going. Point being, don't let yourself fall into a fairly common pattern of when you get to the part of the decision talking about legislative history, starting to skim.
I
say that because that's oftentimes what I did when I was out in law firm. And yes, I see the lovely markings in your textbook there. Matter of fact, you marked every sentence in your textbook.
I don't really have a highlighter, it's how I keep focused.
All right. Fair enough. Do remember, if you are picking and choosing your sources,
this case is a good example. The reports are usually the place that are going to be the most authoritative. The drafters are next in line. Floor statements are going to be relevant. Testimony further down the list. Now, basically though, conclusion was the legislative history supported a fairly stringent interpretation of this text. Make sure I'm conveying this accurately from your perspective.
Yes.
Okay. So, with that in mind, anything else? Is there any presumption they quote, they point to? What about the appropriations legislation?
Yeah, they said, because TVA also argued that the continued funding by Congress of the dam was them agreeing to, knowing about the snail darter, they took care of them. It's still there, it's capable of approval. But the court says that just because the appropriations committee or measures are passed doesn't mean that they still don't expect to follow the other laws passed by Congress, and that if they, the cardinal rule that repealing by implication is not in favor.
Okay.
So if they, just because they passed the appropriations bill doesn't mean that they are implicitly repealing the Endangered Species Act.
Okay. Hold that thought. It comes back in a sort of bitterly ironic denouement to this case. So, I think we would all agree, just in our common experience as citizens, if Congress passes a law and then later passes another law that basically disagrees, conflicts with, or overrides a prior law, the later law takes precedence. Last in time, first in right, to use some inapt commercial language. Okay? That doesn't help us here with appropriations. Because essentially, while Congress was giving millions of dollars to the Army Corps of Engineers to keep pouring the concrete for this dam, even after they passed the Endangered Species Act, even after this lawsuit was filed, that's not enough to overcome that last time person right. Because appropriations legislation is different, or because it wasn't clear, or all of the above, or.
That's a cardinal rule. And then they also said that the House rule, which forbids amendments to appropriation bills, which seeks to change.
Yeah, which I think that's a neat little trick. That's a neat little quirk. The fact that the House rules themselves say appropriations legislation cannot change the law.
Yeah.
They can only allocate the money. So basically, I guess we had, again, the first rule, last in time, first in precedence. The second is, if Congress wants to overrule something, presumption is they have to do it expressly. It has to be pretty clear. The dog that doesn't bark indicates a lack of congressional intent to override the prior legislation. Appropriations legislation, that's particularly apt, because that just allocates money and doesn't expressly set legislative rules or dictates. Now, I'll simply pause and note that there are still lots of things you could do with appropriations to affect the way prior laws are implemented. Congress can say, for example, the Department of Transportation cannot use any funding to dedicate to a program for certain types of mileage efficiency requirements. That's it. The program shuts down for at least that year. That type of funding rider has been used fairly commonly in the past, although it's been subject to new transparency requirements. But by and large, you can't use appropriations legislation to retroactively tweak prior legislation. Okay, so we've now got that legislative history there. Anything else that you fold into the picture?
Oh, then the Constitution and separation of powers that Congress already made a judgment call that no cost is too high to save these endangered species if it's not within the court's power to preempt this decision by Congress. Initially, decreeing that it was what should happen based on common sense in the public.
All right. So
Royce, Charlotte has written the opinion. Are you willing to sign to her analysis now at this point of DVA versus Hill? Does she capture the full gravamen of the majority? Anything you'd add to it? I'm sorry?
For the most part, she did.
For the most part, she did. So okay. There you go. He's now bound to your determination here. Let me add one other thing, because you haven't captured consensus. I want to point out that there is a terminology difference here that would be useful for you in the later parts of the class. There's legislative history, which is the gruesome paper trail left by the creation of legislation by a particular Congress. There's statutory history, which is a different beast. This opinion draws on statutory history when it looks at prior versions of the same statute and sees the arc of how Congress in successive sessions has modified that legislation. That statutory history is a textualist acceptable version of determining intent of the statute, or term, excuse me, not intent, meaning of the statute. In other words, while Scalia would be most likely to say no recourse to legislative history, he is likely to say he's totally fine and expects recourse to statutory history, because that is the words of the law itself, in black and white, even if it's over a series of time. Does that make sense for folks? All right, so just finishing it up. The dissent here is worth noting. Justice Powell, I wish we had time to read it, and also to a certain extent, bottom line is this. He points out that it would have been perfectly reasonable for Congress to have intended that this strict language of Section 7 could still be interpreted to not apply to projects that were underway before the statute was created, especially given the draconian consequences. So even with this textualist approach, there might be some flexibility. Let me then add the denouements, the outcomes of this case. One, when Justice Marshall retired, he willed all of his papers to go to the Library of Congress. Usually there's a period of 50 to 100 years before they become publicly available, not in this case. So we actually have a window into the deliberations of what the court was thinking about this time. And it's pretty clear, Justice Berger thought this was a terrible law. He thought that this was an outcome that was, from a policy perspective, utterly stupid. This decision was written, many people believe, with express hope that it would provoke a congressional response. Essentially, he's throwing a grenade over to Capitol Hill. Congress did respond. The Endangered Species Act was amended so that that process I described to you of consultation, if the biologists say, yes, you may actually kill a few of the members of this endangered species, you can still get a permit for this type of what's called incidental take, as long as the overall integrity of the species is still maintained. Very important exception to this Section 7 language. But here's the real final denouement. Snail darter, gone. After this decision, Senator Howard Baker of Tennessee, in a midnight session, had a rider added to other legislation expressly removing the Teleco Dam from coverage of the Endangered Species Act, a rifle shot exception. They flooded the valley the next day. So, I overspoke. They think relic populations of snail darters in other parts of the valley, but essentially, you know, our talk about legislative responses and veto gates and going back if the legislation is interpreted in a way that doesn't serve your client's interest. This is a classic case where basically, let me step into a personal capacity here, pork barrel politics with the interest of the economic interest overrode what might be viewed as a larger environmental concern. I'll stop politicizing now. Any other questions about the DVA versus Hill case at this point from a statutory interpretation perspective? And this is one of the cases that first brings plain meaning interpretation to life. This is viewed as one of the seminal cases where the text of the statute was adhered to even when it led to arguably a questionable policy result. And that textual approach, that plain meaning approach, was buttressed by recourse to legislative history that supported that decision. Okay? So, with that in mind,
The text offers a few questions after this decision. I did not assign you the Griffin case. It's a fascinating case, but I figured that the reading was punishing enough today. If anybody would like to talk about Griffin, please see me during my office hours. I'd love to kick it around. They ask a couple of questions I will offer up to you, and we may not discuss here because our time's running short. What is plain meaning? I know, that sounds like we're back in philosophy class. But essentially, the book and various opinions basically say plain meaning is when the ordinary meaning of the language can be interpreted in only one way by what we might call a statutory version of a reasonable man, a reasonable person, excuse me. That ordinary speaker of the language of English would read the text in only that one way. If that's the definition of a plain meaning, that raises multiple questions in the sense of that, for example, what do you do when there's a term that has a specialized meaning? We'll talk about some of that next week, but the dictionary off the shelf may give you a radically different answer than asking an expert who actually works in the field what that term means in the area where it's actually being applied. Second, you can have a situation where I think it's arguably fair to say it's rare that any language you write is only going to have one meaning, except in extraordinarily easy cases. You can almost always find some creative interpretation. I'll just leave that aside. Last, your textbook makes an important point, which I want to raise for you. We have a tendency in this class to slide into myopia. We tend to talk about the Supreme Court repeatedly, over and over, to the exclusion of other courts, especially state courts. State courts are different. I tell my other classes this all the time. You commit malpractice if you forget the state. And here, in particular, state laws can have their own approaches to interpretation of statutes. Either the state courts tend to be more towards a plain meaning approach, simply because it's hard to find legislative material supporting statutes for a lot of state legislatures. Texas, fortunately, has a great system, but that's fairly recent. I can tell you there, I spent many a horrible hour listening to reel-to-reel audio tapes to recompile legislative history. There are people who do that for a living. Other thing is that some states have statutes that tell the courts of that state how they have to interpret the laws of that state, which might raise some interesting questions of separation of powers if it was a federal court. But for states, you will find that there are construction codes, including Texas. We'll talk more about the Texas construction code, but just a flag for you guys, I have put it on the website for you to peruse at your pleasure, and we'll get to it later this semester. All right, so that gets us to our last case where we're talking now. We've talked about really sort of the 1978 version of this discussion, which sadly is kind of still in my realm of my memory. Well, now we're going to the newer versions, and this really has arisen more after Justice Scalia and others have raised what's called the school of new textualism, which is essentially plain meaning on steroids. Key thing about the new textualism is that it basically is much more focused on the text of the statute itself for many of the reasons we've already outlined here, but particularly the constitutional reasons. The requirement for bicameralism, presentment, limits the power solely to the text. Intent doesn't bind us law. The new textualism says it's really illegitimate to recourse to legislative history absent very special circumstances. So as a result, you will see this strange dynamic evolving in recent cases where you will see an analysis done by a majority of the court and a dissent by a minority saying, concurrence, but it says we agree, but we're not signing on to any of the legislative history analysis because that's an impermissible method of analysis. And vice versa. There's a case where Scalia did a statement in the majority opinion which basically said, it's illegitimate to use legislative history, and all eight other justices in a footnote said, we disagree. So you'll see this debate happening in the text of the language of the opinions we're talking about. If I had to summarize it, and Professor Eskridge wrote this book, is famous for saying this, you could conceptualize this new textualist approach by saying it's the text, the whole text, and nothing but the text. That means essentially you can look at both the clause you're focused on, you can look at the section it's in, you can look at the act it's buried within, you can even go to the whole code that it's buried within and feel the patterns out and determine what its meaning is on the text. And you can put significant effort to teasing out where those ambiguities are. What you can't do is go behind to find this ephemeral, often illusory, legislative intent according to these believers. And I'll pause. Does that sort of capture our textualist perspective here? If I've done justice to your beliefs? All right. Okay, then our final case for today is meant to highlight some of this discussion. This is the Green v. Bach Laundry Machine Company, which starts with a gruesome set of facts. So, Royce and Charlotte have done yeoman's duty. So, Coda, could you go ahead and sort of walk us through what happened to the unfortunate Mr. Bach? I'm sorry, you're going to have to speak up. I really can't hear you. I won't do what Professor Crump does and make you stand up and talk.
He was a convicted felon on like a work release program. He was working on a laundry machine, greasing into a dryer and a greasing
arm. I'm sorry, you might want to say with more dramatic emphasis, it ripped his arm off, which means it was still turning in the dryer.
All sorts of grotesque imagery. So, he was a felon, work release. What happened next?
He sued for products liability and at trial.
Convicted of what?
Burglary and conspiracy to commit burglary.
Right, so, and the nature of the felony is actually important in this case. Let's keep going.
So they impeached his credibility, and the jury came back with a verdict for bond laundering.
So, and I know, I'm terrible about doing this, but let me sort of convey the flavor of what you just said, which is perfectly accurate. Picture Mr. Bach sitting in the courtroom, nothing on one shoulder, hearing a jury come in basically saying, this machine admittedly ripped your arm off. We choose not to give you a verdict because you were a burglar in an earlier part of your life, and we therefore don't believe your testimony as to whether or not you were instructed in how to use the machine properly. Pausing here. I'm not tipping my hand as to how I think you should believe about this case, but that sort of conveyed the sense of injustice that might have been posed to the justices here. So now, I've interviewed you enough. So what was the outcome of the decision? Who won?
I guess the whole way Bach won. He won at trial, he won at court of appeals, and the Supreme Court of America as well.
The Supreme Court said they overturned the lower opinion and gave him his money?
No.
I was about to say, so he...
There was a very primitive opinion at the trial court, wasn't there? And then he went to the court of appeals because he said that the impeachment of his conviction
okay.
The court of appeals affirmed the lower court decision. And then, I think that's right. And then the Supreme Court, after everything was done, affirmed the verdict for Bach.
For Bach?
Yes.
Isn't Bach the guy who had his arm ripped off?
No, that's correct.
Have I got the case mixed up here? I'm sorry. You're right. I'm sorry. I was thinking for some reason Bach was the poor fellow who had his arm ripped off. You're right. Bach Laundry won the case. Green was the unfortunate fellow sitting missing half of his arm. All right. So the laundry machine won in the Supreme Court. I'll just pause and let that sink in. What possible rationale could justify using a prior burglary conviction to undermine the testimony in a subsequent mutilation incident and deprive this guy of any kind of recourse? In preparing this, but this is one of those cases where it might actually help to diagram out and write the statutory language. If you guys are being paid by the hour to do this would be a valuable exercise. We don't have the time here to do it now. But basically, Federal Rule of Evidence 609A basically says you shall admit this testimony of prior convictions in two instances. And what were the two instances again?
One, if the crime was punishable by death or imprisonment for more than a year.
So a felony, in other words.
Or two was the crime involved in honesty.
Well, is it just a felony? All felonies are admissible? So the judge determines it's probative. And what was the last phrase there?
The value of admitting the evidence outweighs its prejudicial effect to the defendant.
Prejudicial effect to the defendant. Okay. And what's the second?
The crime involved is honesty or false statement.
Does that have to be a felony?
No, it doesn't say.
So if I basically lied about getting a lottery ticket and got a misdemeanor conviction for theft by misrepresentation, basically that's going to haunt me the rest of my life. It's automatically admissible.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Please don't say sir. I age 10 years every time you say that. All right. Is that the only thing? 609A?
Yes.
Well, I'm going to take a look at the footnote on the next page. Right. And what is 403?
Relevant evidence may be excluded if the probative value is substantially outweighed by the nature of unfair prejudice.
Okay. So it's the standard prejudice test. I'm going to pause here. I hope I'm not torturing you guys with things you've already covered in CivPro. Have you talked about evidentiary admission standards? All right. With the Floyd setting, you're probably going to take evidence. I strongly suggest it since it is a key part of the bar. And as someone who did not take evidence or lie to a bar review, I can tell you it made life really difficult my first year as an associate. This is the workhorse. Rule 403 applies to all admissible evidence. The judge gets to make the calls whether or not the evidence is probative and not prejudicial. So 609 essentially is a special exception to that. Use of evidence for impeachment purposes of prior convictions. And here we have Mr. Green. And Mr. Green fell into which one of these?
609.
Okay. Which one?
One.
It was his conviction for burglary was?
A felony.
A felony?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Could the judge have said burglary doesn't matter here? This is a rogue laundry machine ripping an arm off by the Stephen King novel.
Well, it's to the defendant, so Green was the plaintiff.
Right. Is this inherently a one-sided, unfair rule? It basically stacks the evidence and standards in favor of the defendant, but the plaintiffs can have this felony conviction, even if it's totally not probative, even if it's totally prejudicial, always brought in by the plain text. Yes, I'm sorry, that's what they call a leading question in cross-examination. Is that an accurate statement here? Okay. Oh, another 10 years. Okay. So what was the rationale? I mean, we've seen the court previously say the spirit of the law can override. We've seen the absurd results doctrine. We've seen Scrivener's error. Did any of those help poor Mr. Green?
No.
So what was the rationale?
They said that all impeaching evidence has at least minimal probative value and since he was appointed pretty much anything against him, or against him on hold or defendant, so anything against the plaintiff should be admitted. And then they have this super long congressional intent about how the
You think that's super long? No, it's, hopefully we won't do it this semester, but yeah, there are cases where it goes on for page after page, like 20 or 30 pages. But please keep going.
How it started in the House and then the Senate and then the conference committee and how everything came about. And so at the very end, the conference committee said that it doesn't, they made clear in their report that the rule doesn't protect all witnesses and acknowledge and do a prejudice for a civil argument that may influence the trial outcome.
Okay, so effectively then, are they essentially saying this language isn't there? That you can introduce this type of evidence against the defendant and the plaintiff? Which, by the way, was the common law rule before 609A was drafted. Which may explain to a certain extent why the court reaches your analysis of torture, I admit, yes, torture legislative history analysis. Since time is running short, and I can't tell you how much I respect Professor Kumar, and I do not want to give her prep time for this class, let me add a few things, and then we can segue to think about for next week. Notice Justice Scalia's approach. No legislative history, really, at all. It's maybe his real focus is on essentially the logical outcome of the rule. But his perspective is not to strike to the defendant. His principle of doing the least violence to the language of the law is to add one word. Limit that to criminal cases. To respect the constitutional thumb on the scale designed to protect individual rights when faced by prosecution by the overwhelming power of the state. Again, arrived at in a fairly straightforward acknowledgement that the result otherwise is absurd, if not unconstitutional. He's willing to look at materials, if need be, to make sure that this conclusion is absurd, is rational, but his focus predominantly is on the text of the statute. The other dissent from Justice Blackmun, interestingly enough, would basically expand it to the defendant and plaintiff. His rationale is the same way the language has a gap and you're trying to do least violence to the rule, you're better off expanding protections rather than interpreting it narrowly and taking away the defendant that might be otherwise originally expected by the defendant. Remember, the majority analysis here basically took out the ability of the defendant also in a civil case to object to the admission of felony evidence. So as you can see, this case highlights how the text of the statute can be important as a launch point, but the three models of interpretation here reach radically different conclusions on the same language with radically different outcomes in terms of the effect on plaintiffs and defendants. The opinion by Scalia is noteworthy because it's one of the few times you will ever see Justice Scalia actually refer to legislative history. But by and large, he used it to support his conclusion as how he would want to interpret the language. So with that, I am going to pause and offer a preview. First of all, any questions before I depart? Okay, we're in the wrap-up. Everyone's here, ready to go. Next week, we're moving past theory. We're actually going to start going into the specific tools we're going to use to interpret statutes, including how you divine the ordinary meanings of words. Yes, dictionaries will be coming up to stage. We'll also be talking about some of the first tools at the most atomic level of statutes on how you interpret grammar, structure, and reading the language really in vacuum to discern its plain meaning without having to go outside the language of the exact provision you're dealing with. As part of that discussion, I will offer a quick overview on the general approaches we've talked about and also some of the key things we want to take away from this idea of new textualism, so that you can use those when you're applying some of these very specific canons that are going to be the next couple of weeks in our class. Bless you. That's a perfect way to end the class. Anything else? Okay. With that, have a fabulous weekend, everybody. I hope you survived Mardi Gras last night. See you next week.